At the feet of Marpa, the translator, I bow down. This song is on how to approach reality. Where there's nothing that's seen, this is seen by far supreme. This is the innate mind, the luminous light. Where there's nothing to search for, this the discovery supreme. This is the innate mind, the treasure trove. Where there's nothing to be eaten, O satiation supreme. The food of samadhi, the food that liberates. Where there's nothing to be drunk, O satisfaction supreme. This is the drink of bodhicitta-amrita. This is original wisdom, simply aware of itself. This is the realm of the inexpressible. This is not within reach of shravakas or naive ones, nor is it the sphere of experience of a logician. If you realize reality past all bestowing and past all receiving empowerment supreme. If you realize reality past all high and low, this is what's known as the Bhumipa supreme. If you realize reality which is unreachable by advancing along a path, that's the path supreme. If you realize reality past all birth and death, this is what's known as fulfilling the highest need. If you realize reality past all perception, this is what's known as the valid cognition supreme. If you realize reality past all greater and less, this is what's known as the jnana far supreme. If you realize reality past all good and bad, this is what's known as the method far supreme. If you realize reality past duality, this is what's known as view by far supreme. If you realize reality free of reference point, this is what's known as meditation supreme. If you realize reality free of adopting and free of rejecting, that's conduct far supreme. If you realize reality free of all effort and strain, this is what's known as fruition far supreme. If you have any questions about the text or the songs or perfect purity, I'm happy to try to answer.
Become popular.
Yeah, that would be great.
I think it can be done.
Right now, they are all the songs are available in a book.
Really?
Yeah.
But singing?
Singing, there's one of Rinpoche's students who sings the melodies so that you can learn. It's not me, no, but probably maybe better. But the main thing is to learn the melodies so that we can sing ourselves. So the tapes aren't like professional tapes, but that's okay. If you can learn the melody from it, then you can sing, and that's the main thing. Pardon me? The words are important, and to be able to sing is important because it's much easier to memorize, and you like it better. People like to sing better than just to read. Yeah.
So you're saying that the actual melodies are on tape?
Yeah. Yeah, and I will write down the email address, and we'll tape it up somewhere. Yeah, great. So people who want to ask questions.
Please ask it with the mic on. It's got a little switch on the back and on and off switch. Off, mid-range and on, so just make sure you have it all the way to the on position before you talk. Thank you. Anybody have a question?
Not anymore.
On mic. Okay, well, if we do, sit right here.
You want to ask? Okay, just so they can record it, that's all. So that.
The thing is that I'm thinking of the word intuition in accordance with the partner mind, the insight, the purity self. It have to be done by intuition or touching by intuition, not by intellect. Is that so?
Well, it's definitely the case that the wisdom is intuitive. So that means that wisdom knows in a non-conceptual way. And so that's, I think, going in the right direction. But we have to sort of see the context of what we mean by intuition and in what context we're following it. If you have a dream and you don't know you're dreaming and you feel like you have some intuition to do something in the dream, then it doesn't matter if it's intuition or intellect or not, because we're still taking the dream to be truly existent, then it's going to produce some type of confused result. But on the other hand, if you know that if you know you're dreaming, if you know that what appears is appearance and emptiness, and then you follow your intuition, then you won't be confused. Or if you follow your intellect, you won't be confused.
Well, I was thinking more as that in order for us to know our own purity, it's only intuitively, not with words. That's what I'm referring to it.
Right. That's right.
Thank you.
I'm not sure I have a question formulated, but I've had these fleeting thoughts since this morning's talk, so I'll express them. the first one is like, I was thinking that I have dreams where I'm just watching the dream. Often I'm watching my neurotic self do things in the dream and know that it's just a dream. And then I was imagining having that perspective on this dream. And there was a feeling of disloyalty for stepping back, you know. So that was one perception. I don't know whether that's so much being attached to this dream or, but there was some kind of feeling of betrayal of having that same perspective on this dream. That's one thing I wanted to say and you could comment on. But the other thing is it's very hard to, I was catching a glimpse of your interpretation of the text and this moment-to-moment opportunity. And I'm trying to, I know it's not conceptually, you're not able to express it conceptually, but I'm trying, is it, it just seems like there's all this confusion going on all the time, like non-stop. And is it just gone in those moments, or is it still this sort of background stuff, but you see that it's confusion, and so there's another opportunity? That's my question, I think.
Well, let's start with the second one first. It's not that the confusion disappears, but rather we start to recognize that the nature of the confusion is wisdom. So then, when you have that type of understanding, it gives you a lot of confidence, which is that however much more confusion there appears is fine, just more wisdom. And there are a lot of metaphors that are used by the great masters about that. Like, if you go to a land where there's no water, there's only ice, and you want to drink, then the more ice you have, the better. And another one that is that if you want a fire to spread in the forest, then the more wind you have, the better. And the way Rinpoche said it on Maui is that it's like if you're a surfer, the bigger wave, the better. So the key is for us to understand and how it is that the confused mind is actually just an expression of wisdom. So how are we going to do that? And that's what we want to do. So it gets back to something that was just said about the non-conceptual and the inexpressible aspect and how to recognize that as the nature of thoughts and emotions. And that's what this book is about, because it's talking about self-awareness, self-aware wisdom. And the way that we are introduced to self-aware wisdom as beginners is to try to find it in our own experience, in our own emotions. So we can do that quite simply by just looking at an experience of a disturbing emotion, like anger, and then saying, well, what? So we can say, I'm angry, right? But if we then ask ourselves one more question, which is, what is that like? Then you can't say. You might be able to describe some physical sensations. It makes me feel hot, it makes me feel tense, it makes me feel one thing or the other, but even if you go one step further with any of those, then you arrive very quickly at inexpressibility. At the actual feeling, the actual experience is inexpressible.
That's self-awareness. The self-aware mind is inexpressible. At the same time, it's totally aware of what's happening. We know perfectly well what we're feeling. So it has this wisdom aspect, at the same time it's the inexpressible aspect. And when we look at a feeling of happiness, actually you end up at the same place. That's the amazing thing. There's no difference. It's equally inexpressible. Say, I feel happy, what is that? It's inexpressible. It's just the luminous energy of the mind. And our habit is to label this luminous energy, this awareness, in different ways. And then get either attached to or averse to those different ways. And then that attachment or aversion produces more attachment and aversion. So we get very far away from the original experience, and we get very wrapped up in the attachment and aversion to the experience. But the good thing is, even the attachment and aversion is the same. It's just the inexpressible energy of the mind. And so if you get yourself very angry or very aroused in one way or the other emotionally, and you look at that experience, it's very bright, it's clear, and it's beyond labels, it's beyond there being some object and some subject. It's just this inexpressible experience.
Including the attachment?
Yeah. Absolutely. It's perfectly pure. Now, this is talking about the perfect purity. Right, so if you, we can do that, I think, pretty easily from just looking at it from the perspective of our own experience. Now, then you can start to apply these different analyses to it, like the middle way analyses and the analyses that are presented in this book to help us understand about emptiness. So what emptiness is helping us to see is that this experience is not definable or locatable in any way. And it's not locatable in terms of this entity of a person divorced from everything else in this particular time, in this particular place. It's truly beyond the concepts of space and time. And so this is something that we just start to understand more, and you can always bring it back to your own experience by just looking at the feelings and just confirming that this is actually how it is, using this simple process. Then learning more about it through studying, through learning the analysis, singing the songs, seeing how Milarepa experienced it, and Gotsangpa and others. And then, I think to bring in the first part of what you're saying, is that it's natural for us as ordinary sentient beings to have some kind of discomfort or distrust of this, right, of what this is. Because we're just not used to it, right? So you described it as disloyal, feeling disloyal, or there's some kind of fear that we have. And so that's okay. If we just know that that's going to be there, that's okay. That too we can analyze in the same way and find out too that it is also just the inexpressible energy of the mind. And it's a process of becoming more and more at ease with the true nature of reality. So I think not to be discouraged by this type of experience that you're having, but rather just to probe it, you know, from sort of like an objective standpoint. Say, okay, you know, I don't feel good about this, or this doesn't feel right. Why not? You know, let's see. Let's look into it. Are there advantages to thinking things truly exist? The problem is that when we first sort of approach this from the outside, we have this very kind of like binary way of looking at things. It's either one or zero. It either exists or it's nothing. So a lot of times feel like, well, if I see my life as a dream, then it's like sucked out all the meaning, or it just seems like some kind of nihilistic thing to do. But it's not like that. It's not one or zero. It's the union of appearance and emptiness. And the experience of appearance emptiness, all the siddhas say is spacious and relaxed, and it's easy. And you don't feel nihilistic. You don't feel like you're ignoring anybody or ignoring your situation. You're just experiencing it actually in the fullest way. Because when you experience it as appearance emptiness, then there's nothing that you're afraid of. There's nothing you're going like this to. There's nothing you're going like this to. Right? You're able just to experience it purely and fully as it is. And if you think about being in a dream when you know you're dreaming, and you just really like put yourself in this experience, I think what we find is that we don't feel nihilistic, we feel much more open towards others and able to relate to others in a pure way, in a compassionate way, than ever when you're taking somebody to be a solid entity and yourself to be solid and this like dualistic appearance to be true. And so it's just a matter of getting used to it, using all of these different methods of the songs and our own analysis and study and everything, and looking at how Rinpoche is and the teachers are, you know, Ponlop Rinpoche, Karmapa, who have this level of realization. And then that, all of that helps us to become more confident.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Is purity the same thing as emptiness?
The way that Rinpoche explains this is to say that if you look at the nature of, let's say, desire, which is the first of the perfect purities, then at the level of not analyzing it, it seems to be truly existent. At the level of some analysis, you don't find anything, so you conclude it doesn't truly exist. And then at the level of thorough analysis, then it's beyond conceptual fabrication. You can't say it's existent, you can't say it's non-existent. It's beyond any concept of what it might be. So that you could call emptiness, right? You could label it emptiness as long as you had the understanding that it's beyond the idea of empty or not empty.
Or pure.
Right. But the fact that it's beyond conceptual fabrication means that it doesn't have any stain. It can't have because it's beyond conceptual fabrication. And in that, there can't be any fault. Right? So if you think about, so this is sort of from an experiential perspective, and that's why it's really the ultimate teaching of the second turning. Because like Rinpoche taught us today, normally the ultimate teaching is described as the emptiness beyond conceptual fabrication. But what's the experience of that? It's perfect purity. It's like how you experience appearances in a dream when you know you're dreaming. Everything is wonderful. Everything is perfectly pure. There's not the tiniest atom of impurity anywhere. Right? It's not the same as a purity that is the opposite of an impurity where you're clinging to one and you're averse to the other. Right? So this is how we know the difference. Because if it's just like a samsaric type of purity, then you want the pure thing and you don't want the impure thing. Right? But here, it's the experience of everything is wonderful. There's no aversion to anything. Right? There's openness to everything. And so that's perfect purity. And that's the nature of all phenomena. What do you think?
Semantics.
Semantics.
That if what is ultimately unable to be communicated, that's a better word than purity, which carries a connotation of that without stain, because if it is beyond conceptualization, then it must be beyond the concept of stain or no stain. And where I get really confused is, or not confused, but uncomfortable, is the concept of anger is perfectly pure, and therefore all feelings are perfectly pure. There are two statements in there, and I think what I hear is that anger is essentially empty of duality between the subject and the object. But the concept of pure or without stain, because great actions are taken out of anger that are not pure. And if samsara and nirvana exist at the same time, I think that something that is beyond conceptualization, to choose a word that is not neutral, is implying right there's some sort of conceptualization. Does that make sense?
I'm sorry, it's implying what?
That if something is beyond conceptualization, the notion of purity or that without stain, which has a positive connotation, is itself a conceptualization.
Well, first of all, we have to make sure that we separate between these three levels of analysis. In answer to the question, to the part of what you were saying about negative actions taken out of anger. So that's occurring at the level of no analysis, when everything is assumed to exist as it appears to exist. So at that level, which is the level the Buddha taught at the first turning, during the first turning of the Wheel of Dharma, then the Buddha taught that these three, anger, desire, and stupidity, are poisons. Right? The Buddha is the one who gave this name, the three poisons, because they are poisonous to oneself and to others. So if it's a poison, it's something to be abandoned, right? It's something to be gotten rid of. So it's at that level that the Buddha taught the antidotes. Like when you get angry, you meditate on love, you cultivate love, and so forth. Right? So all that's at the level of no analysis. Then, when you analyze to see if these things truly exist or not, then you find total logical, total illogicality in the assumption that they truly exist.
What's the logic?
Well, when does anger arise? Does anger arise when it exists or when it doesn't exist? It doesn't arise when it exists because it's already there. But it doesn't arise when it doesn't exist because there's nothing there to arise. And it's like talking about a baby being born without a baby. That's one way to analyze. Another way is to say, if anger exists, where is it? You know, point it out. Where is the self who gets angry? Right, these are all the different ways to analyze. Where does anger, if it exists here, where did it come from before it was in me? And where does it go when it's finished? It doesn't come from anywhere to me. If it didn't come from anywhere, how can it be here now? So there are lots of different logical ways to analyze that, and it's up to us to see which one seems to help us the best to understand it, to sit down and to... This is what, like, the whole Sun of Wisdom is about. It's helping us to figure out these ways to analyze. But these are just some simple ways. If anger exists now, at what time does it exist? You say, I'm angry for 5 minutes. Well, what is 5 minutes? 5 minutes is just 300 seconds, right? It's just a conventional name that's put on things that don't exist at the same time. There is no 5 minutes. There's just 1 second. Well, even 1 second, you can analyze and see 1 second doesn't exist because the first part of the second is gone and the future part of the second hasn't happened yet, so you're just left with the middle part. Well, what about that middle part? You can analyze that too. You can't find the tiniest moment that you're actually angry. And then also we can analyze it from this experiential way, which we were just talking about. I'm angry. Well, what is that? Anger is just a word. It's just a word of the English language. It's not the experience that we're having. The experience you're having isn't connected with any word. Right? And we know that because it's the thought, I'm angry, that is projecting this label onto the experience. The experience you had in the first instance already finished by the time you think you're angry. So for these reasons, anger is perfectly pure. It's like the experience of anger in a dream, when you know you're dreaming. And like you said, then what you find is that it's beyond concept. And so then, if you think about it, then why should it be described as pure? Well, to describe it as beyond concept is also a designation. Right? So we might think it's more neutral than saying it's pure, but that still is a designation. But then to go further and to say it's pure is connecting with the experience of anger when you realize its true nature. You know, that is pure, because the experience of it is open and spacious and relaxed. And it's not a klesha, it's not a disturbed experience, it's an experience of the true nature of mind. And the luminous nature of the mind. And that feels very good. So there's no problem then with the label of that as pure. It's an accurate label of it. It doesn't mean that from the perspective of the experience itself, there's purity. Right? It's because from the perspective of the experience you can't label it pure, then that's why we can call it pure afterwards. Right? Because if there was some label connected with the actual experience, then it would only be in one language, maybe Sanskrit. Then the Tibetans couldn't have called it Nampar Dakpa. We can't call it one thing in Spanish, another thing in English. But because it's inexpressible, then we can put all these labels onto it. And another reason why it's called pure is to connect it with the teachings of the other parts of the Dharma, like the third turning. Third turning talks about the Buddha nature, pure of any stain. All right, so that's just talking about the true nature of mind. And that's the same as anger, because anger is just, when you talk about the true nature of anger, it's just talking about the true nature of mind. Or when you get to the teachings of the Vajrayana about pure vision, being able to see the others as deities and your own true nature and your own mind as wisdom. So how are you going to do that if we still have an idea of things as being truly existent? Now then pure vision just becomes like putting the Halloween costume on the other person, right? Wait, hold still, I have to put this mask of Vajrasattva on you, right? But if you actually know it from, can relate to it from these teachings of the second turning about appearance and emptiness, and about the mind being clarity and emptiness, then people are naturally deities. Because everyone is just this inexpressible manifestation of radiance. You don't have to think of them as a deity or not. Just by knowing that, you've got pure vision completely. Right? Then it's given the name pure vision and the name seeing everybody as a deity, but that's what it actually is. So in this way, we can see how all of the teachings of the Buddha fit together. Other questions?
Thank you. Just for clarifying some concepts or the way we say it. You said in the morning, and you have said a couple of times now, that, for example, happiness and suffering are the same thing, or they're not different. Well, on the first level, with no analysis, there are differences. On the level of appearance, there are differences. They're different. They are not different in terms of their ultimate mode of existence. Right, in terms of being empty, of inherent existence, of independent, solid, or whatever existence. And they're also the same in terms of being both the expression or the display of the basic luminosity of mind, right? But in terms of appearance, they are different. Is that right? I mean, just clarifying. Okay.
Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Uh, I'm relatively new to this, so my question, you were saying that the first turning is no analysis. Could you explain for me then the basic concept of the second and third turning so I can kind of grasp this a little more?
Well, in the first turning, the Buddha taught about a self who performs actions, either virtuous or non-virtuous, and experiences their results as being either suffering or happiness. And for as long as one still is in samsara, then even the happiness that is experienced as a result of positive actions isn't true happiness because it doesn't produce lasting results. And so then you still have this, you're still caught up in this attachment and aversion. So this is sort of the basic samsaric framework that the Buddha said we participate in from time without beginning in one life after the other, and then we'll go forward until we achieve liberation from this. So all of this presumes that there is an individual, right? So that's why it's from the perspective of no analysis, and presumes that everything that happens with regard to the individual exists. So then in the second turning, then the Buddha said, when you analyze these, the self and all these other phenomena, you find they don't truly exist. So that's the level of, that's called the level of slight analysis. So that's like the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra says, there's no eye, there's no ear, no nose, no... Everything is no, right? So it's no because that's from the perspective of slight analysis. But then the level of thorough analysis is actually also where in the Heart Sutra when it says there's no wisdom and no, there's no attainment and there's no non-attainment. So that's the level of thorough analysis you realize is beyond the idea of non-existence too. So that's the freedom from all conceptual fabrications. So that's the second turning. The second turning, in the second turning, the Buddha taught from the perspective of refutation. Right? Refuting what does not truly exist, refuting conceptual fabrications. From the in the third turning, the Buddha taught from more affirmative perspective. And there he taught the true nature of the mind of every sentient being is the Buddha nature. Is original wisdom. That is beyond concept. All right, so how do these two turnings fit together? They fit together in that the when the Buddha taught about wisdom in the third turning, then he didn't teach about it from the perspective of being a truly existent thing. Meaning that it's not something you can know in any dualistic way, like a cup or a book or something like that. Because you can analyze it too, and you can't find it. Right? You can analyze it in all these different ways and find it's beyond conceptual fabrication. Right? But still, when you know that and you rest in meditation, you don't just dissolve into nothingness. You have an experience of luminosity. So that shows that the mind is the union of luminosity and emptiness. It's not just one or the other. It's just a matter of emphasis. In the second turning, he emphasized more the emptiness. In the third turning, more the luminosity. But the perfect purity versus we can see is where this kind of comes together. Because purity is not a refuting perspective, it's an affirmative statement, right, about the nature of the mind.
So then that millisecond, that split second between luminosity and the nothingness, is that where we're actually wanting to be?
Well, it's that the luminosity and the emptiness are undifferentiable. Milarepa gave the example of the sunlight in a cloud-free sky. It's the undifferentiability of the awareness and the expanse. They're never separate. Any other questions?
Hello. I just wanted to see if I can figure this out. One's reaction to the experience is open and relaxed. And is that because you realize that everything is equal, that there's not any grasping or pushing away? So you can just relax in it, and it's like a kaleidoscope of emotions where the color black and the color white are not any different. They're just a color. Okay. Well, then, at that point, it seems like the edges get really fuzzy, and you just kind of slop over into other people's stuff, too. Is that?
Well, then look at the nature of this thought of fuzziness. Mm-hmm. And what is that? That's also just the inexpressible energy of the mind.
Mm-hmm. But it's not just your own mind anymore, it doesn't seem like.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's no your mind.
Right.
Or others' mind,
right.
Or not.
And wisdom comes out of that, or it seems to.
Well, that is the wisdom, actually. Mm. It's the undifferentiable, luminous emptiness that's non-dual. Mm-hmm. It doesn't belong to me or you or both of us together, right. Or neither of us.
Right.
It's just beyond any concept of what it might be. Mm-hmm. Any label we try to put on it to describe what it is, doesn't fit.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Right, so then when you rest in that, then you still have these experiences of appearances and emotions, but you start to be able to recognize them as the play, the energy of this wisdom. Like when you look at waves coming up out of an ocean, mm-hmm. It's just the ocean, right? It never leaves being of the nature of the ocean. And our thoughts and our emotions and perceptions never leave being of the nature of this luminosity. That's what we train in recognizing.
I was wondering, bouncing off of Marilyn's question, where does the mind stream as a concept? And when you are in this place of purity where luminous and emptiness are undifferentiable, does one let go also of the concept of mind stream living from one existence to the next? Do you lose the essence of path here? As Milarepa said, there is no path, sort of that essence in some of his songs and things that you've taught. So at some point, do you let go of there's an essence of us that's going to go to this place or that place, or little grains of sand on the beach sticking their little heads up saying, I'm here. I don't know what to do with mind stream in this. Or do I need to just forget about it?
Well, I think it's helpful to analyze the concept of it and to see that it just doesn't make sense. The idea of going from one existence to the next falls apart under logical analysis. Because at the end of this life, right, are we the same as or different from the being in the next life? Well, if we're the same, then this life didn't really end. But there are no past and future lives to speak of because it's the same. But if it's different, that means that the being in this life died, and then the being of this in the next life just came out of nowhere. So there's no connection. So if it's truly existent, it's impossible. But since it's not truly existent, it's perfectly possible, because it's just a dependently, or it's just a mere appearance. So then we can talk about, not even talking about past and future lives, but when I was 7 years old, I did this. Mm-hmm. Or yesterday, I did this. And it's not the same I. Mm-hmm. There's nothing the same, but we can say that with no problem, because it's just a dependent imputation.
So the thought of a mind stream is more a relative perspective.
Right.
On the issue.
That's of the nature of appearance emptiness. Mm-hmm. So mind stream, mind itself, is just its
so
appearance
when
and emptiness.
They give the analogy of all of this being an ocean and the drops just melt back into the ocean in terms of some words to use to explain it. In other words, could you say like there's this humming energy and out of this, or luminosity, whatever you word you want to attach to it, these appearances happen and they're there in any given moment.
Right. And they're of the nature of the luminosity. At the same time, the luminosity doesn't really exist either. Right? That's an important point to realize. Because otherwise we start clinging to like the idea of luminosity or energy as being truly existent. But it's not, because you can't find it.
Even as if we conceptualize the Big Bang and being a tiny speck.
Right. I mean, where is the speck?
Right.
Right? There's no big and there's no small.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yeah.
I know the session is just about over, and I know this question is not really necessarily appropriate in this context, which is why I waited till the very end. And I just was wondering, and I know you'll say no if you need to, if you could share just a little bit about how it is traveling and translating for Rinpoche, just a little bit of story line, if.
It's great. I think it's great to be Rinpoche's student in any context. I feel like very much a part of the event of receiving the teachings from Rinpoche. Just so it feels to me more like we're all on the same, we're all receiving these teachings together. And wherever that's happening, it's fantastic. At the same time, and it's something that Rinpoche helps me to be aware of, is that it doesn't really matter what you're doing. You can be in the presence of the Lama or not. It's your own mind. That's the important thing. Right? As long as we like take things to be truly existent and grasp onto them, we could sit here and get the teachings for forever. Right? But if you leave and you apply these teachings in your daily life, that's a much better situation for you to be in than for me to be traveling with Rinpoche all the time and taking things to be truly existent. Right? So this is, I think, very important. The most important thing is we really don't need anything more than what we get in these 3 days of teachings with Rinpoche. It's just a matter of putting them into practice. And anybody's able to do that in any situation. Rinpoche has great confidence in us. In us. Rinpoche could spend his time doing anything he wants. You know, he could have a monastery. You know, he could have 10,000 students. He could teach His Holiness Karmapa, you know, 6 months a year if he wanted to. He doesn't do that. He goes around and teaches for 3 days or 4 days or at the most a week or two in all over the West. Because he has great confidence in Westerners and their ability to put these teachings into practice in a very profound way. And he has the ability to present us with very concise, profound teachings that are just totally suited to that. So that's my favorite part, is to see the people who come to the teachings and how much benefit it is. Well, thank you. I mean, it's because everybody's here that I get this opportunity, so thank you very much. And let's close by singing the song of the profound definitive meaning sung on the snowy range. Supreme Guru, I bow down at your feet. The cities of blessings come straight from the dark innings. Some Maya's nectar is the most nourishing drink. Your offering of faith has kept me so healthy. This way of gathering merit, it works quite well. For the mind that masters view, the emptiness dawns. In the content scene, not even an atom exists. A seer and seen, refined until they're gone. This way of realizing view, it works quite well. When meditation is clear light river flow, there is no need to confine it to sessions and breaks. Meditator and object refined until they're gone. This heart bone of meditation, it beats quite well. When you're sure that conduct's work is luminous light, and you're sure that interdependence is emptiness, a doer and deed,
find until they're gone. This way of working with conduct, it works quite well. When pious thinking has vanished into space,
no
44 swords, 8 dharmas, no hopes and fears, a keeper and kept, refined until they're gone. This way of keeping samaya, it works quite well. When you finally discovered your mind is dharmakaya, and you're really doing yourself and others good, all winner and won, refined until they're gone. This way of winning results, it works quite well. Oh, faithful students, to answer your request, this old man is singing a song of happiness. The snow fell and sealed me in my retreat, where the Dakinis gave me all I need. The pure snow water was so delicious, with nobody practicing, practice was glorious. Without ever working, the harvest was perfectly reaped. Without accumulating wealth, the treasure chest was filled. Looking at mind, I see everything. By staying low, I have come to seize the throne. I have reached the highest peak. That's the Guru's kindness to me. Now, sons and daughters, students gathered here, in answer to your faithful service, I sing this song, teaching you the true Dharma. My benefactors, may it fill your hearts with joy. May all your hearts be filled with joy. May we live long and be free of illness, enjoy freedom, great resources, and happiness. Next life may we meet in the pure realm. May we always practice Dharma and benefit beings.
Thank you.
Thank you.